Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Now You Know, talk radio where you get to ask.
Or if you're not in the chat room but you're listening some other way, if you could also somehow give me a signal, give me a sign, and there are many different ways you can do that. The first one is to call in to our hotline, which is 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO, also known as 877-695-7234. You can also send us a message on Twitter. Our Twitter account is @NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO. You can message us on AOL Instant Messenger. Also, our account there is NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO. And finally, you can email us at info@nowyouknowradio.com. So there are all kinds of ways that you can get through to us, get a message to us. And right now, I'm asking you all to make sure to let me know that you can hear me. And I see from the chat room we have a yes loud and clear. Thank you very much. And that was from my lovely assistant, Tyler Mountain, who is manning the chat room right now, or I guess the PC version of that would be personing the chat room. Anyway, as I said, I am very sorry to announce that Brian is no longer able to produce the show due to other commitments. Now, for those of you out there in radio land who aren't sure what it is that a producer does, a producer is the person who basically mans the switchboard, runs the radio back end, and does all those sorts of things. And so we are now breaking in a new producer. His name is Evan, and actually I have muted him because I have that power, but I'm about to unmute him so he can say hello. Evan, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Evan. Why don't you just say hi to everybody?
Hi, everybody. I'm Evan. Glad to be here producing the show.
Evan, this is everybody, and I'm going to now mute you again just so that you aren't on the spot and you can sort of go back to the work you're doing. But I would ask for the people that are out there listening right now, even if you do not have a question for our guest, who we will talk about in a minute, you know, if you have just a minute or two that you could call in and let Evan practice screening on you, we would really appreciate that. Let him practice taking those calls, because Evan is a very capable person, but this was not anything he had ever signed on for when he started working with me. And I have to say that he really just stepped right up to the plate, and he's doing a fabulous job. But it is certainly not what he was originally planning to do. So if you're out there and you have a couple of minutes that you could call in just to let Evan practice on you, and who knows, you might even actually have a question for our guest. And again, the number to call in is 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. You can also send us a message with a question on Twitter. The account is @NowYouKnowRadio. And that's the same account that you can reach us on AOL Instant Messenger, or you can send us a question by email at info@nowyouknowradio.com. Okay, so we are here to talk about electric cars and all sorts of things having to do with electric cars. Now, my first question is, did anyone out there, or who among you out there, has seen the movie Who Killed the Electric Car? Now, you can't see me, but I'm raising my hand because it was quite an interesting and eye-opening movie to watch. And I have to confess, I really never had much of an interest in electric cars. It wasn't sort of an area of interest for me. And yet, when I watched that movie, I found myself getting so swept up in it. The story is so compelling. And even if you are not even the least bit interested in alternative energy, and I don't know how you couldn't be at this point in this country, but even if you're not, it is a tale of corporate intrigue, corporate greed, corporate mismanagement, and it is very much a David versus Goliath, or in this case, Chelsea versus the man sort of movie. It's a tale of someone whose heart is compelling them to act out of belief, deep belief in what's right, taking on the big corporate powers that be, and it's a very, very interesting movie. So, with that, I would like to ask you to call in and tell me what you thought of the movie, if indeed you saw the movie, or again, you can message us through Twitter at NowYouKnowRadio, or by an AOL Instant Messenger, also at NowYouKnowRadio, or you can email us at info@nowyouknowradio.com. And for those of you who weren't here for the announcement last week, we also now have a spiffy new page on Facebook, and that Facebook page is facebook.com/nowyouknow. Don't even have to use the radio on that one. Okay. Now, I do have to tell you that we seem to have misplaced Chelsea. So if it seems like I am right now trying to fill some time, that is in fact exactly what's going on. We are having some technical difficulties, but she is in the process of calling. And if you could just hang on 1 second, I'm going to ask Evan. I'm going to put him back on the line, in fact. So, Evan, I know that Chelsea has been trying to dial in. Do you happen to know what kind of problem she's having?
Yeah, so I just got a hold of her on her cell phone, and so she's trying to call in through the toll-free number, and for whatever reason, okay, this is probably her.
There she is. All right, I'm going to mute you. I'm going to let you pull her in, and you can let me know when she's ready.
Okay, great.
So that was some very good timing. Now, of course, in the meantime, we have, as I mentioned, Tyler Mountain, and he is in our chat room. And so if you want to chat with Tyler, if you, that's another way that you can ask a question, you can relay it through the chat room. I know a couple of you are already in there. So we have so many different ways that you can talk to us tonight, that you can tell us what's on your mind about the state of alternative fuel, electric cars. You can ask Chelsea Sexton a question, all these different things you can do in all these different ways. Again, give us a call at 877-NYK Radio. That's 877-695-7234. You can reach us by Twitter or AOL Instant Messenger at Now You Know Radio, or you can email us at info@nowyouknowradio.com. All right. So, Evan, is Chelsea ready to talk with us?
Yes, she is.
Awesome. All right. Well, without further ado, let's talk with Chelsea Sexton. Chelsea, are you there?
I am.
Oh, Chelsea, it's so nice to talk with you again. How are you?
I am well. I'm thrilled to talk to you finally.
Well, I'm sorry you had trouble calling in. I really apologize because I'm almost certain it must have been something on our end, and I appreciate you persevering. And we are so excited about having you here on the show. And we already have some questions lined up for you, but we're going to not just jump on you like that. First, Chelsea, tell us what you've been up to.
Oh, you know, sort of raising Cain and causing trouble a little bit here and there. You know, we're working on another movie after we were very well surprised to find that the first one was seen by a few more folks than besides just our parents. This is what we thought would happen. And lo and behold, not only did our little movie get seen a little bit, but even better, automakers are actually starting to build electric cars again, which is really what we all wanted in the first place. So we are now a couple months away from cars and showrooms, which means there's all sorts of activity on sort of wonky things like chargers and incentives and policy stuff, and I get to sort of play in the thick of all of it. So it's lots of fun these days.
Well, Chelsea, for those of our listeners who may not yet have seen the first movie, which is called Who Killed the Electric Car, could you just give us a little bit of a background? And first, I have to tell you that, and I don't know if you heard me saying this, but when I watched the movie, at that time, I wasn't really that aware of the issues surrounding electric cars and alternative fuel vehicles generally, and I certainly had absolutely no concept of what had gone on with the EV1 and with you know, that effort behind the scenes, and certainly not with the owners who, from what I gathered from the movie, were just in love with this car and basically being told, too bad. And So it was a really compelling story, even for someone who isn't as savvy about cars, or indeed, may I say, as in love with electric cars, as clearly you are. You're obviously very, very passionate about this subject. So could you just sort of give us the thumbnail synopsis of what the issue was that led to the first movie and the first wave of this?
Sure. I come from California, and for decades we have had air quality problems, and particularly, sort of in the 70s, 80s, 90s, lots of really bad smog problems, and California kind of looking for a way to solve this. And at one of the LA auto shows, as car companies always do, General Motors showed an electric concept car and kind of said, hey, this is, we think, the future. And a few months later, they announced in Washington, D.C., on Earth Day, we think they might actually build this. And the state of California was watching and went, really, you guys can do electric cars? There's zero emission. There's no pollution, which means no smog. If you guys say you're really ready to do this, we're going to actually mandate that all of the major manufacturers, if they want to keep doing business in California, also do some really clean cars. We'll let you sell what you always sell, but you have to do some that are really clean. And the top six automakers, the three from Detroit and the top three Japanese manufacturers, all made electric cars. But as nobody likes to be told what to do, they also really started fighting this law and just went at it in court and legally and through sort of policymaking and various things, really tried to get rid of it and put some cars on the road in the meantime, expecting no one to really like them. Consumers instead loved them, and they were waiting lists for more, and they were forming owners clubs and different things. But when they finally got that law watered down enough, they decided to take the vehicles back and crush them. And with very little explanation
to
the consumers.
Could you back up a minute?
Yeah.
Because I want you to repeat that.
Sure.
They decided to take the cars and do what to them?
They would take them back from the people that loved them, and they would crush them like little electric pancakes.
Crush them.
The vehicles
they'd
crush them. They'd put them in a grinder and crush them. And the vehicles had only been leased, so they were technically allowed by law to do this, even though there were people that were trying to buy these cars and love these cars and lived every day with these cars and thought they were fantastic. And the buyers, the owners that didn't get to really have a say in the matter, decided that they couldn't let the whole thing go on unnoticed. So they did all sorts of protests, and I got involved with them then and sort of helped try to lead it and do different things. And we got a couple manufacturers to stop the crushing. Ford and Toyota both stopped. And GM was more reticent about the whole thing and decided they really just didn't want to be in this business anymore. And all of the automakers behaved badly. None of them were good. It was just sort of degrees of badness. And at the time, a couple of the EV drivers said, you know what, we have to sort of try to tell this story. And so a couple of them got together and made this little movie, and it was called Who Killed the Electric Car? It came out in 2006, and we really did think we'd burn copies for our parents and move on with our lives. And lo and behold, Sony Classics bought it and put it into theaters, and it since has been out on DVD and showing on TV and different things, and has gained enough of a following that we thought, as automakers have been announcing new electric programs, that we really ought to try to tell the next chapter. And so we have a new movie due out next spring called Revenge of the Electric Car, and it largely covers this next chapter of these different efforts to bring this technology back, but also, in many cases, the human interest elements and kind of, can a company like GM save itself with the Volt, or can that Volt play a role in the saving of it at least? And can a smaller company like Tesla really ultimately compete with the bigger boys of the traditional automotive industry? And where do, the guys we endearingly call the mad scientists fit in, the guys who convert cars in their garages and that sort of thing? And within each of these entities, there's all sorts of real personalities, guys like Bob Lutz and Elon Musk and different folks. And so we just sort of follow them on their adventure to try to, recapture their own legacies, but also to reinvigorate a technology that we should have always had, but we're finally making a true attempt at doing.
So let me ask you this, and again, we do have callers, and we promise we'll get to you shortly, but just before we move on to a point where we may be not talking about the movie, can you tell me two things? What would you say is the biggest impact that the movie has had on both the auto industries and public awareness? And also, what's the biggest impact it's had on you? I don't know if you intended to sort of be propelled as you have been into this advocacy role, although you do it very, very well. And so I'm just, you know, if you could, I'm really curious about both of those.
Well, I think on some level we'd like to believe it's had some level of awareness on the industry. At the same time, I don't think any of us are arrogant enough to assume that. But certainly, I think for a variety of reasons, public awareness and PR problems being one of them, and certainly our film played a role in that. But also for, you know, just current economic reasons, most automakers have come to understand that if they want to continue to have a place in this industry, they have to start making something new and things that consumers want, which also in turn puts more responsibility on consumers to ask for what they want. But this was really the first time, maybe 5 years ago, that consumers really started in mass to ask for what they want. And it embodied everything from calling the 800 number for your Chevy company or Nissan or whoever your favorite automaker was, to literally sending personal emails to Bob Lutz, who at the time was the vice chairman of General Motors. So really consumers embraced this idea of, we're going to express something, we're going to see if we can make a difference here and vote politically, but also with our wallets, and refuse to buy another gas car till the car company I like makes one that has a plug on it and that sort of thing. And I think that has had some impact. Certainly, it's an ongoing effort to keep consumers engaged in that regard. But I think we've all gotten a taste of the fact that consumers and sort of regular people like me can indeed have a voice in this matter. In terms of sort of the personal aspect of it's been a bit of a ride. The irony of the whole thing is that I'm one of the shyer people in the movement, was never supposed to be in the movie, was rather shocked to find myself in the movie, and let alone anything remotely public in the industry or the movement. So it's been a little bit of a coming out party, but it's really remarkable to find that we do indeed have an industry, and a lot of us who've been around for a while joke that, you know, we're getting the band back together, but we finally have an audience, and that's a really invigorating thing.
Well, speaking of the audience, let's go to a question, and we have Rob in the Santa Clara area, and he has a question about batteries. Rob, are you there?
I am here.
Hi, Rob. You have a question? You're on the air with Chelsea Sexton. You have a question for her?
I sure do. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Can you hear me? Okay.
I can.
My question really has two parts. So the first part is, given the technical progression of car batteries, when do you think we will see batteries on the market that will enable an electric car to go as far and as fast as a gas-powered car on a single charge? And the second part is, what are the main technical hurdles to overcome to get there?
Okay. Well, what's interesting is that we do actually have at least one car that can go as far as an average gasoline car and quite a bit faster. The Tesla Roadster has a current range of about 245 miles per charge, which is about as far as I actually get in my Saturn. So there are some gas vehicles that will go further, but about 250 to 300 is fairly average for a gas car. And it will do 0 to 60 in 3.9 seconds for their slower version. So from a performance perspective, we're kind of there. The challenge is price. The Tesla Roadster is wicked fun to drive, but it starts at $109,000, which is a little bit out of my price range. So the mission for batteries really comes down to getting the price down or energy density, depending on your priority. So we have a bunch of different electric vehicles coming. Most of them are 100-mile electric vehicles because the industry really has come around to understand that there's a fairly large market for a 100-mile electric car that is cheaper and that someone would use for commuting in a two-car household or something versus a long-range electric car that is, you know, $70,000, $90,000, or $109,000, or whatever it is. That said, batteries are getting better, whether more energy dense or cheaper, on the order of about 7% a year. So it takes several years to sort of halve the cost or double the range, but it is certainly happening. And in the meantime, we have a whole different sort of flavor of plug-in vehicles that are coming, and those are plug-in hybrids. And they have a certain amount of electric range and then the gasoline backup. So if you're somebody that kind of has an average commute Monday through Friday, you could maybe never use gasoline during your commute in something like a Chevy Volt, which has a 40-mile range of electric range. And then on Saturday, if you wanted to drive long distance, you can put gas in the same car and go long distance. So it kind of has that best of both worlds feel to it. So we do have certainly goals and places we want to go with electric vehicles, but we're already starting to see a nice variety that doesn't provide something for everybody, but provides something for a whole lot of people.
Rob, are you there? Did that answer your question?
Yes, I am. Yes, it does.
Did that
Thank
answer
you very
your
much.
Question?
Yes.
So on a somewhat related note, and thank you for the call, Rob, on a somewhat related note, Chelsea, I'm curious about, the electric cars. Well, a couple of things. I do not, there are some things I really understand well. This is not one of them, so this may be the proverbial, dumb question. But one of the things I don't quite understand is how come if you have a car that's a hybrid, how come the battery can't be being recharged by the engine when the engine is running so that you don't have to plug in before you can go electric again? Is that a question that makes sense even?
It certainly makes sense, and that's how roughly a lot of today's gasoline hybrids like the Prius operate. You put gasoline in it, it has an electric motor, it has a battery, and the only way that battery ever gets recharged is through the gasoline engine. And to a certain extent, that's a little bit how the Volt operates, although rather than try to recharge the battery, it after your 40 miles, you plug it in, you go 40 miles, and after that, the engine runs just enough to give you range and not so much to try to recharge the battery on top of that, because why would you want to burn more gasoline than you have to? And so the effort is more get you where you need to go, but let's not burn more petroleum. And the reason that we tend to still want to plug in is because it's a whole lot cleaner than gasoline, even with coal on the grid. We're about 50% coal, give or take a couple percent in this country. And even with that, the plug-in version of a vehicle is about twice as clean as your average gas car. So that's the worst-case scenario, twice as clean. But it's also a whole lot cheaper to drive on electricity than to drive on gasoline. So your average cost per mile in an electric car or the electric portion of a plug-in hybrid is generally 1 to 2 cents per mile versus, on the low end, 10 to 12 cents running on gasoline. So between cleaner and cheaper, it's already pretty compelling to run on electricity. And then a lot of people really resonate to electricity because it's domestic. We're not importing petroleum from anywhere in order to run your vehicle. So a lot of people love these sort of self-sufficiency empowerment aspects of driving home at night, plugging it in your own garage, never having to go out of your way to a gas station, and running on domestically made fuel.
Okay, we have a question that has come in through Twitter, but first let me just remind everyone that you can reach us by Twitter and also by AOL Instant Messenger. Both of those accounts are Now You Know Radio. You can also call in at 877-695-7234. That's 877-NYK-RADIO. Or you can email us at info@nowyouknowradio.com. Also, we now have a weekly newsletter that tells you about upcoming shows, gives you links to the interviews once they're published, and you can sign up for that right at our website at nowyouknowradio.com. And, Chelsea, the question that's coming through Twitter has to do with, it said, you're talking about the batteries, but they don't seem to go a whole day yet, and what about charging stations? Isn't this sort of a chicken and egg situation where if there aren't enough charging stations, then people can't really run these cars as their daily drivers?
Yeah, I mean, chicken and egg is a common perception, and what we actually find in sort of regular practice is that the vast majority of EV drivers plug in at home and at night. While you're sleeping. So the cool thing is the car fills up overnight. You leave every morning completely full, usually with an EV that has at least 100 miles of electric range. If you're a pure electric car, if you're a plug-in hybrid, then you have 20, 40, however many miles, and then gasoline as a backup. So most people get well through their average day and even 2 or 3 days without really needing to plug in, but most people do plug in anyway just so they're always full. And then we absolutely believe in sort of a sprinkling of public charging, and that has always happened in the areas where we've had cars. You know, California and Arizona and Georgia and various places have had some public infrastructure. It's always been free to use, so you can plug in if you're at the shopping mall or going to the movies or wherever. And people can use that either to extend their range or just as a comfort measure. Some people just want to make sure that they're always full. And so they'll plug in as they run around from place to place and never have to worry about being empty. And that's continuing to happen as automakers have started to announce their early market areas. We have 2 electric cars coming before the end of the year, the Chevy Volt and the Nissan Leaf. Both of them have announced which market areas are coming first. And so we've already started to put charging in those cities to make sure that it's a little bit ahead, at least, of the cars that are coming. And ideally, we'd start with the sprinkling and then layer on more as we see where the cars go and where the people who have those cars drive and really need the charging. And so we keep, you know, a small amount of resources really serving the most amount of vehicles.
Now, you mentioned a couple of different states, California certainly. You said something about Georgia, which kind of surprised me for some reason. I don't know why. I guess I just haven't thought of Georgia as a hotbed of you know, electric vehicle technology. But what are you seeing in terms of adoption in the state in their power grid infrastructure to support electric vehicles? And I'm surprised and heartened to hear you say that most people for their regular daily use wouldn't need to actually plug in every day even. But still, there's definitely a perception that people need that ability. And I know California is talking about putting in more charging stations, and I said you mentioned support in Georgia. But generally, are you finding that adoption and support in the state, you know, in the legislatures is an uphill battle? Are they really interested, but they're just not sure what to do? Or how are you seeing that playing out?
We're seeing a sort of a variety of interest. Certainly not all places are interested. But it's always been the case that if you sort of draw you around the country, sort of the Northwest, the Northeast, and the South, sort of Austin and various areas, but also Atlanta and South Florida and various places among the South, there's always been that market interest, and we still call it the EV smile because it kind of looks like a smile around the country. And those areas have always been into it. Georgia was part of our last generation. We put some EV ones there and things. This generation, we're seeing the most interest and the earliest deployments in Washington, Oregon, California, Austin, New York, a little bit in Florida, and Tennessee and Arizona, and then certainly Hawaii has gotten on board most recently. So it's still kind of sticking to those rough areas that you would expect. And we're seeing not only certainly a market interest that's always been there, but some policy interest in terms of putting in infrastructure and supporting with incentives. Georgia and California actually both have $5,000 incentives toward the purchase of an electric vehicle, which helps bring down the price in the case of the Nissan Leaf to $20,000, which really puts it in the category of an affordable car, which is something we hear
That's
a lot.
Awesome.
And new technology is more expensive. Yeah, and it will continue to be a bit more expensive than regular technology, but we're also trying to get it supported and incentivized such that it really does kind of come close to it to what you'd expect to pay for a new car. And as the technology gets cheaper, the vehicles will as well, and that kind of thing. And then the other thing we're seeing is sort of some regional competition. We're seeing places like Raleigh, North Carolina, really want to be one of the EV capitals. And so they've gotten their local McDonald's to put in charging stations and different things. And in some cases, it's incentives. In some cases, it's infrastructure. In some cases, it's free parking at meter, you know, parking meters and that kind of thing. Each place is trying something different. And a few years ago, we got together with the Rocky Mountain Institute, and a bunch of the stakeholders all got in a room, and we created something called Project Get Ready. And it really is a blueprint for any city or region or county or area that wants to make itself plug-in ready. And it's kind of a matrix. It's available for free, projectgetready.org. And you can go see this nice little blueprint of all of the things that people who've been doing this for a while really have thought are the most effective. And not every area has to do them all, but it helps give any particular city or region a place to start in terms of if I want to get my area ready for this, what do I do and how do I do it? And we have some places that are being more forward-thinking than that, even in more creative, you know, places like San Francisco that are redoing their building codes. So if you're building a new apartment building, you have to wire a certain amount of places, parking places that could be EV spots. Even if the chargers aren't there yet, the wiring will be there. And, you know, we have a couple of home builders that every time they build new model homes, they wire the garages in case that new owner wants to have an EV. Because when you build the home, it costs, you know, a couple $100s to put in the wiring versus a few $1,000s to try to put in the charger later. And so really sort of thinking ahead to how can we make this as easy and cheap as possible. And if you don't get one, it's no big deal. It didn't add a whole, you know, a couple $100s to the price of the house. But if you do want one, we certainly have made it easier for you.
Well, and it also would add to the resale value of the house, even if you don't yourself use it. That's really interesting.
Absolutely.
We have another caller who would like to talk to you. Let me just remind everyone, you can call in to talk with Chelsea Sexton about alternative vehicles, electric vehicles, at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-6234. You can send us a message by Twitter or AOL Instant Messenger to Now You Know Radio. You can email us a question at info@nowyouknowradio.com. And I have been remiss in not mentioning that you can also dial in, as it were, and talk to Chelsea via Skype. You just go to our website at nowyouknowradio.com, and there's a link right there to click on, and it will launch your Skype, and voila, you'll be with us. All right, let's go to Jeff in Boulder. Jeff has a question about electric vehicles and job creation. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you for
letting me ask
the question. Hi, I was just wondering what you thought the prospect of electric cars would have on job growth in like terms of infrastructure creation and the like, and just building them, I suppose.
Actually, we're seeing quite a bit of opportunity in this space and even the tangential areas. You know, when you talk about electric cars, we always end up in conversations about renewable energy and solar and all of those different things, which exist on their own as their own industries, but also each one combined helps the other one make a little bit more sense. So we're seeing a lot of job creation in those areas, and certainly as these technologies become more popular. But the number one factor has been the fact that we have the first president ever who is actually supportive of these technologies. And President Obama became very supportive long before he was president, but certainly drew a line in the sand when he did get elected and said, look, we're going to have 1 million plug-in cars on the road by 2015, and not only end up backing that up with stimulus dollars, not just for the vehicles, but very much for the components. And we now have an emerging battery industry in the United States that has historically only existed primarily in Asia, Korea and Japan and China, for building battery packs for these vehicles. And so now we have a number of plants that are opening in Michigan and Indiana and different places to help support all these vehicles. So between the vehicles themselves and keeping plants open that had been closed or keeping them open where they would be closed and that kind of thing, we just had a Saturn plant that was bought by Fisker Automotive, which is a new emerging entrepreneurial automaker. So certainly on the manufacturing side, but also on the component side, whether it's batteries, we'll ultimately see it with power electronics and capacitors and all the various things that have to go into these vehicles that really help on the job creation side.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for the call, Jeff.
Yes.
Chelsea, we have a question now that's actually coming by email from Susan. I'm not sure where she's from, but she says, would you please tell us about the new movie, Revenge of the Electric Car is a great title. What's the movie about?
Well, this film is an interesting title. Our first movie was very much a murder mystery. We had 7 suspects. We declared some of them guilty by the end, and it sort of had that framing about it. And we kind of thought, well, after you've made a murder mystery, where do you go from there? You got to make a monster movie. And so we have Revenge of the Electric Car, and it's a little bit, at least in our own heads, has that sort of Frankenstein's monster revival kind of thing about it. And we're very much tracking some of the various efforts to bring electric cars back. I think certainly when we envisioned it, we would have been able to cover all of the efforts, and now this thing has grown so big that we can only cover a few of them, and frankly, we couldn't be happier about that. So we have, you know, a couple of major automakers and their role in this, and particularly a couple automakers who only a few years ago were rabidly against electric cars and now are the most aggressive for them. And you know, that's GM and Nissan, and there's, you know, pretty much every automaker now has some electric car project. Some are more aggressive about it or more sincere about it than others, but they're all in the game somehow. And then we have this emerging class of entrepreneurial automakers that didn't really exist before, companies like Tesla and Fisker, Better Place and Coda and these guys. And we can't cover them all, but we've picked one to cover there. And so we'll, you know, certainly talk about Tesla a little bit. And, you know, not only the sort of the ambition of a guy like Elon Musk or any CEO of such a company, but also the barriers to entry and, you know, the fact that we haven't had, you know, before Tesla, we hadn't had an IPO since Ford in the automotive industry. This is a really old school industry. And now we have all these sort of scrappy new upstarts largely based in Silicon Valley trying to challenge the old guard, and how will that go? And certainly we have a lot of grassroots sort of consumer-oriented folks that have been converting their own cars and creating kits for other people to do it. And, you know, the people that we really endearingly call the mad scientists. And not all of them are average Joes. You know, guys like Andy Grove, who are known for running Intel, are kind of mad scientists in our industry because they put forward these really ambitious, provocative plans to convert millions of vehicles across the country and do it by next year and these different things. So it's mostly a human interest story about all of these different people that are trying to change the world in their own ways, and how even when you can agree on the goal, you know, putting electric cars back on the road, it's still really hard for us to get out of our own way as a society, and all the challenges that really are resident in such a mission.
Well, so tell me, actually, you bring up something that's always been in the back of my mind ever since I watched the movie, and talking about the big automakers and their sort of change of heart or you know, sort of their turnaround. And you mentioned at the top of the show that GM recalled these cars and then they were just crushing them. And mm-hmm. even though, as I recall from the movie, you know, as you said, because they were leased to the people driving them rather than sold, they were able to do that. And it was just heartbreaking to see these people who loved these cars, who wanted to pay for them. They wanted to buy them. They wanted to be able to keep driving them and keep them on the road. And they were told, no, you're not allowed to. And we're just going to take them and put them in lots and never let them be driven again. And in some cases, literally crush them flat and just make them into scrap. And it was, like I said, it was heartbreaking. It was almost like, even though they're not alive, it just felt almost like they were actually literally killing these things. And first of all, I couldn't understand from a financial perspective how that could possibly make sense. And I don't know if maybe you can understand, having spent some time in the retrospect now, if you have been able to put yourself in sort of the mindset of what GM was thinking, you know, how that could have made any sense from a business perspective. And then, well, if you could answer that, then I'll give you my follow-up question.
Sure. One of the things that we kind of always knew being the thick of it, but that really congealed as we were trying to make this first movie and condense it to 90 minutes, is that the story is really complicated. And, you know, people love to sort of ask, what was the moment in which GM changed its mind, or any automaker? You know, it went from an automaker that seemed to be, when we launched the EV1, very much behind it, couldn't be more so, had the full weight of a massive multinational company behind it, and then all of a sudden seemed to sort of not be behind it anymore, and suing the state of California and different things. And it was always a case where there were people that from day one loved that car like I do, and there are people that never wanted to see it happen, and there are probably people of both stripes that exist in the company today. But from a financial perspective, it started out a very small program. It was meant to get bigger. It was certainly sustainable in terms of a business case on its own. But in the volumes that they ever built the car, it was very expensive to build. And GM loves to toss about numbers of it cost $100,000 to build each one and that kind of thing. And when you're building four a day, that's probably true. And, you know, supplier relationships, when you're asking for 250 of something versus thousands, the costs are going to remain high. So from a financial perspective, to continue to build at those volumes is probably not sustainable. That said, once you've built them and given them to customers and they love them, I'm not sure how much cost you recoup from taking them back and crushing them. And so certainly that was a question. The warranty costs were blamed and different things, but the cars were largely trouble-free. And so certainly, if nothing else, it was a massive PR mistake and the financial ramifications of that from taking the cars back. At the same time, you can't help but compare an attitude like that with something like the Prius or even the first Honda Insight at the time, where both companies didn't sell very many their first couple years out. In fact, they only sold a couple thousand vehicles each, not nearly enough by any automotive standards to keep going, and yet they said, we really think this technology is going to be a huge future player, and we're going to keep at it, and now they can't build enough. And so it's hard not to look at the various EV programs, the EV1, but the RAV4 and the Nissan and various other ones as well, and think if they had just kept going, it was a niche product then. No one who's got any experience will pretend it was a mass market product, but it was a good niche product with a good following that probably could have been a much more mass market product today, and the automotive industry not nearly in the spot it's in had they been more forward thinking. But that's just not how the industry worked at the time, and they're still struggling to work that way now. It's a very short-term thinking industry who looks at things by the quarter, not by the year, and certainly not several years. And at that time, SUVs were wildly popular, and they were making at least $10,000 gross on each vehicle versus not nearly that much on an electric car. And I think it really boiled down much more to a philosophical question of, how do we get behind these green cars that make our Suburbans and every other car we make a lot of money on look really dirty? And there's a comparative issue there between the core product and their future-looking product that a lot of people had a hard time getting their heads around. It boiled down a lot to a basic humans are afraid of change kind of struggle. And they still struggle with it, and they've come a long way, and we've come a long way, and it's starting to happen, but there's still a huge danger to becoming complacent right now, thinking, oh, this is happening, car companies are building electric cars, it's all going to be fine, because we went through that. We had years of cars on the road and still had it all go south. And so there's a few of us that are still really kind of guarded about getting too comfortable now before we really get to a place where the market takes over and we no longer have to push so hard.
Well, let me ask you this, Chelsea. This was my sort of follow-up question to that. I have to imagine that when the movie first came out and then at its height of its popularity and viewing, that GM could not have been very happy with you. And I would imagine...
I'm sure that's true.
and I would imagine, knowing as I do how large industries work, that might have even translated to other of the big automakers also being wary of you. And yet you seem now to really wield quite a bit of influence, and you seem to have a lot of friends in high places at these same automakers. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you were able to sort of win their hearts and minds, or at least their respect, despite the fact that you really came up swinging at first.
Yeah, I'm sure that I still have my face on a number of dartboards out there. I'm sure a lot of them have been at GM and may still be, although the irony is I'm talking to you from a hotel room in the middle of GM's Renaissance Center as we speak. Part of the mission for many of us along the way was to kind of call out what we saw and the mistakes, but not condemn the companies behind them. All along, I think huge mistakes were made on EV1. Some great things happened on that program, too. It was a brilliant car. The engineers were spectacular. The way it ended was awful, and there's no bones about it. And shame on them. there's no way to defend that. At the same time, boycotting companies and telling them no matter what they do, we'll never buy a car from them again, doesn't give them any incentive to do better. And a lot of the people that played the bad role, so to speak, or made the poor decisions on some of these programs are no longer there. So it's tough to hold a company in its current state responsible for decisions that were made 10 years ago or longer. And so on some level, there's been a little bit of, you're going to have to prove it, but if you can prove it, I'm happy to root for you. I mean, I still want this technology to succeed. I want these early programs to succeed. Some days I feel like the den mother sort of cheerleading every company just trying to do it. And other days I still am the one holding the stick going, what were you thinking when you said that or you did that or whatever? But I've always been very candid, and I'm kind of known for that. And most of the automakers have come around to understand that I'll say what I think, and when you do good things, I'll root for you, and when you do bad things, I'll hopefully, you know, I'll come to you privately first, and hopefully never have to go public. But that balance, I think, has allowed many companies to come back to this and to allow me into the room and different things, because they know they're just going to sort of get it unvarnished. There's not going to be a lot of gamesmanship going on with somebody like me, and that the public kind of resonates to that as well. I'm simply one version of the public they have to win back. So right. It's in some cases easier for them to learn from somebody like me, because I've been where they are and I understand the challenges they're facing. I know how hard this is. We skinned a lot of knees on our own in EV1 days in that last generation, and sometimes it's frustrating to watch them skin the same knees again. It's a little bit like parenting teenagers. You know they have to make their own mistakes, so you desperately want them to learn from yours. But at the same time, there's a lot of new things going on, too. And so to the extent that they're willing to let people like me step in and help and prevent at least a couple of those skin knees, then we're happy to do it. I mean, we ultimately want this to succeed. So this is not about punishing anybody. And most automakers have come around to see that. There's a couple that remain uncomfortable, and they might get around to it, and they might not, and that's okay.
That makes a lot of sense. And just to remember, we have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Chelsea Sexton. She is an expert on alternative energy vehicles, particularly electric cars. In fact, she's the star of Who Killed the Electric Car, and she's working on a new movie now, The Revenge of the Electric Car. And if you have a question for Chelsea, you can call in at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-NOW-YOU-KNOW-RADIO. Or you can send us a message by Twitter or AOL Instant Messenger to Now You Know Radio. You can email us at info@nowyouknowradio.com. You could Skype in through the nowyouknowradio.com website. All these different ways to connect with us. And we have a question that was left on our voicemail, actually, someone that couldn't listen live but really wanted to get the question to you. It's a bit long, and I'm not going to edit it because I might miss a part, so I'm just going to quickly read through it. It's from Ted in California, and he's very interested, he says, in the truth about electric cars. And he says, however, at his age, he's learned that the money people don't seem to care what the other people do. You have the Tesla and people still dying from electrocution from voltage and frequency of alternating current in 60 cycles. And now he's talking about Tesla, the scientist, not the car. And he proved that it could be done much better at 1,000,000 volts and 1,000,000 cycles per second. And it would go around you instead of through you. Then we had other inventions that came along, like the Chrysler turbine-powered car, which was destroyed along with the Chrysler Corporation. And let's see. And so his question to that is really simple, he says. What is it that you think you're doing or can do in the near or distant future to change the attitude of the big automakers to make things happen when they have never happened in our foreseeable, not-so-distant history? Did that make sense to you, that question?
Yeah, sure. I think in terms of what I can do, what any of us can do, with respect to the automakers themselves, is the, you know, I think he's right, that in large part, the money dictates a lot. And so to the extent that the automakers can be convinced that there is money to be made here, they're going to go there. I mean, ultimately, they want to build what sells. And if a certain number of people want a certain product, they're going to build it and keep building it. And it's actually something that we've been hearing for years from them, which was, well, we don't have people that are requesting electric cars for the millions, therefore they must not want them. And, you know, on the surface, that makes a little bit of sense. But at the same time, I sort of come back with, well, how many of us looked at a Walkman 20 years ago and said, I wish this were the size of a deck of cards and I could watch TV on the thing? You know, none of us would have imagined an iPhone or an iPod or an iPad looking at that device. And so part of our mission and my mission from a consumer education running around standpoint is to help people see the iPod and to help them ask for it. But it really does become our responsibility, therefore, to ask for it and to not settle for products that we don't want in vehicles that we don't want and to ask for what we do. But also, when we have automakers who do start making what we want, to support them and not flog them for past mistakes and that kind of thing, but really evaluate them fairly and objectively on what they're doing now. And so that becomes a lot of the mission of, you know, raising awareness, getting people to vote politically. That matters quite a bit as well, but also vote with their dollars. And truly, if we demand and prove demand for electric vehicles, it's going to be really, really tough for them not to build them, especially given the history and the awareness that already has been raised. So, you know, this could go the way of the turbine, but if it does, we're going to have ourselves to blame as much as the automakers.
Well, in that vein, it seems to me that, you know, the Prius in many ways did wildly better and still does than I think many of the pundits had anticipated would be the case. And I think part of that may or may not have been, and I'd love to have you address this, you know, the price point, you know, as you said, now with the incentives, the price point isn't that much higher than some of the even mid-range luxury cars, for example. And so I'm curious if some of the fervor with which now other automakers are looking at electric cars has to do with they saw the success that Toyota has had with the Prius. Would you say that's accurate? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I think Toyota's success with the Prius has certainly been a lesson and a cautionary tale. You know, a lesson that new products and new technologies can succeed even when, you know, if you're looking at it purely from a pragmatic perspective, they don't seem obvious. You know, the early hybrids didn't pencil economically. You would not have saved as much on gasoline as you had to spend as a premium to get the car. What none of the automakers understood is that's not why people were buying the cars. And all of the automakers still struggle with understanding that early adopter market. It's not a space they're used to playing in. They're used to playing in 100,000 or more vehicles per year, per model, mass market, really common denominator stuff. And maybe we have a couple of Viper-ish programs that sell in small numbers and have enthusiasts and stuff. But when it comes to EVs, it's nothing that they understand. And it frankly scares, I think, a lot of the automakers. They see that early market as these bunch of protest-wielding, willing to buy a Tesla kind of money sort of folks that are not pragmatic or understandable in any way. And that's part of the role that people like me end up playing as well, is just sort of playing interpreter and helping them get used to this place and be rather the community-oriented technology that it is, and how to really use that to their advantage and cultivate ambassadors. So it's not a pricing issue, because those early adopters aren't as price-sensitive. They tend to have more means than the mainstream consumer, but they have different requirements that certainly have to be played into. And once automakers can sort of get arms around that, they really can be successful. And I think that's where some of the automakers that have started to make entree into those communities have really seen us. You know, we've brought in old EV1 drivers to drive the Volt or the Nissan Leaf or, you know, different vehicles, and they have really come back. You know, the most cynical people, I'll never buy another EV or I'll never buy another GM product, have come away going, God, that Volt's really cool, and wow, that company's really behind it. I had one guy who would never have bought a GM product again come to one of those drives, and he said to me afterwards, he goes, that was not the General Motors that killed my EV1. That was the GM that built it in the first place. I
wow.
see that spirit again in that company. And it really does come down to a lot of experience-based stuff more than a commercial or even the car itself. We have these weird conversations. Like, great car, but I'm sorry, building a good car alone will not be enough. The last generation didn't suffer for lack of good cars. You have to do all the soft stuff around that. And they're learning, and there will be some mistakes, and there have been, and there will be, and hopefully they'll get past them. And that's what we're all holding our breath for, because ultimately we all want to win this.
That makes a lot of sense, and that's very heartening. We have just a few minutes left, and we have a question that's come in through AOL Instant Messenger. And again, that AOL Instant Messenger ID is Now You Know Radio. It's also our Twitter ID. And Brian in Chicago wants to know how plausible it would be to design solar panels for electric cars. You know, and he says it seems that in certain environments that would be beneficial, and I certainly could imagine here in Boulder, Colorado, which has, it seems like, about 420 sunny days a year, you know, to have panels on the roof, you know, would that be possible? Is it in fact plausible?
It is technically possible, not quite to the point of being really plausible yet. The challenge with solar panels is they either tend to be very heavy or they require a lot of surface area. And so they're not yet to the point of being efficient enough as their own technology to really keep a car charged, let alone avoid needing to plug it in. We have started to see, you know, the Prius that has an optional solar panel on the spoiler and different things to run the air conditioning, and you can technically run a little fan and that kind of thing in the car, but they're really not robust, and they tend to be more for show than performance. Where solar really makes sense is to put it on the roof of your house or your carport or a workplace carport for electric vehicle charging in a workplace, because then you can charge your car all day long or store it and charge it at night, but then you can also run your house. And so as a use of solar panels, it's much better to put it on a building and use that to run the car and the building than to try to put the panels on the car. Ultimately, I think we'll get to that point of being able to put them on the car and have it make economic sense, but we're just not quite there yet.
Well, Chelsea, I have to tell you what, we are out of time. You have been absolutely delightful. I so appreciate you joining us on the show, and I'm wondering, would you come back again?
I would love to. I'm so thrilled to have been here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's Chelsea Sexton, and this is Anne at Now You Know Radio. And be sure to join us next week when our guest is cult relationship expert Barbara Fifield. And what makes her an expert, among other things, is she herself fell under the spell of a cult leader and was involved in a relationship with him. So she'll be here with us next week to talk about that. And remember, you can leave us a message telling us what's on your mind at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. You can send us a message by Twitter at Now You Know Radio, also AOL Instant Messenger. Or you can send us email at info@nowyouknowradio.com. And finally, sign up for our newsletter. You can do that at our website, nowyouknowradio.com. It will give you all the information about upcoming shows, and it will also give you the transcripts of the interviews with previous guests. And finally, our Facebook page. And you can actually sign up for our newsletter through the Facebook page as well. That's facebook.com/nowyouknowradio. And I just want to say thank you so much to our new producer, Evan. He did an absolutely fantastic job. Evan, it was a pleasure having you here. Welcome aboard. I think you're on the air now, so you can say hello and goodbye to everybody if you would like to.
Bye-bye.
Here you are. Evan, thank you. You did a fabulous job.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. We will talk to you next week.